Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 19th, 2017, and welcome to episode 149 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. And turning on old programs, it would seem. Hi, I'm Michael Mulhern. I'm your host for today's show. With me is a selection of our hosts, so let's see who we have out there. Ah, Paul, how are things at your end of the world?
Things are pretty good. The weather cannot decide what to do. It was something like 60, I think, last time we recorded, and then we had a blizzard. Now it seems to be sort of sunny, but they've turned off the heat. anyway, yes. So if you hear chattering over here, it's just my teeth.
You better sort of get a few extra processors running on that machine to kick in the heat.
That's, of course, what I should be doing.
Yes. Turn on some of those retro computers to warm you up.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of a warm spot in the world, hi, Jack. How are you? Long time no hear.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a while. I'm pretty good. I've had a bit of a cold last week. I'm still trying to get over that, but otherwise pretty good. And Sweden is, as typical, not warm. It's sunny today, which is nice, but heading towards spring slowly.
Someone made a mistake. The sun's not supposed to be out yet, is it?
I know. It's crazy. What happened?
Mm. And hiding up in the northwest, hello, Earl.
Hi there, Michael. Well, up here, the sun decided to peek out today, so that's nice. The other thing peeking out are spring allergies, so I'm sneezy and coughy and all the other evil dwarfs, but...
I like coffee.
Coffee. Coffee's my favorite dwarf. Yeah.
Doing well, thank you.
And his cousin Espresso.
Yes. And his evil twin Java.
Oh, well. Yeah, things have changed. I think last time I was on the show, I said something about laying out fire hoses and keeping an eye on my combustible backyard so it hopefully didn't burst into flames. Well, we've just had a week of continuous rain, so where things were dry and tinder-like, it's now soggy, sodden, and of course the humidity's kicked in, so there you are. It's from one extreme to the other, so the weather, its variableness is its only constant.
Yes.
Okay, so host topic. Well, Adobe Illustrator has recently turned 30 years old. AutoCAD's 34. Word, Excel are positively old, or at least over 30. And Mathematica 28, and there's quite a lot of serious software out there that is starting to get the years up there. Even my venerable and favorite emulator DOSBox is now 15 years old, I'm told. So I thought what we'd do is, what new versions of old applications do you still regularly use today? So I suppose there's quite a bit out there, but let's see, Paul, what new versions of old applications do you regularly use?
Yeah, that's a interesting question. In real life, I don't know if I actually do. I mean, I try to avoid using Microsoft Word as much as I can. Sometimes I'm forced to. So, but it doesn't bear much resemblance, I think. I did recently read an article, which I think almost made it into the show notes, but didn't, about the sort of the well-designedness of WordStar for even sort of modern word processing applications. So perhaps I will think about going to try to use WordStar. But I don't know. I mean, I think I do use Photoshop with some regularity, but that's only, what, 93-ish or something? 92. When did Photoshop start? Anyone know?
Don't know.
Not off the top of my head. Yeah.
Not as old as Word, but... Mathematica. See, actually, what I'm seeing here when I see Mathematica and DOSBox and stuff are things that I should use and want to use. I haven't used Mathematica since it was a new thing for the Next. But
right.
Okay, yeah, somebody else.
In answer to your question, Google tells me that February 19th, 1990 for Photoshop.
Okay.
It says that's its initial release date.
Okay, it wasn't too far off, but I was a little, I took it to be a little younger than it is.
Well, it doesn't look a day over 20.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was some precursor to it. Let's see if we go into Wikipedia, font of all knowledge, says that a not publicly released demo, January 1988.
Ah, nice.
First distributed commercially by the scanner company Barney Scan in 1989. Oh, there we are. So, a few precursors there. So,
I fairly recently just got the PowerPoint. I think we talked about this maybe last time you were on, but PowerPoint 1. So. Just after Microsoft took it over.
Yeah, I've got, that was the, is it Foresight?
Forethought.
Forethought, yes. Yeah. I've got that boxed as part of my early Office software for the original Macintosh. So that's part of my acquisitions to have the actual original boxed software manuals, disks, the works, so...
Mm.
Managed to find that one. That one pops up on eBay every now and again for obscene prices. I'm glad I didn't even pay a fraction of obscene for mine. But
just ob.
Yeah. Well, actually, it wasn't too bad. I paid more for postage to get it here to Sydney, but that's just typical. Okay, so you're a little bit of Photoshop and a reluctant Word user.
Yeah.
So,
and hopefully future WordStar user.
Yeah, I should have a look at WordStar, see how it goes. So let's see, Jack, a little bit of programming, I suppose, perspective. Anything there that you're using new versions of old software?
I guess I would say essentially all of the what we think of as the typical Unix command line utilities. Most of those have heritage way back into the 90s or 80s or even 70s, and I'm still using that directly or indirectly. All the time.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from compilers to Vim to whatever.
I agree with you. I was actually using it last night for some support. So, yeah.
And those things, I think it's hard to even, it's we think of those as kind of like the substrate of what a lot of us are doing. If you're doing any kind of tech stuff involving any kind of Linux or Unix or whatever, it's in there somewhere and you're using it all the time. But as far as like GUI applications, the only thing that comes to mind is like on my Mac, I still occasionally use the TextEdit app, just sort of the included simple text editor, just for some simple stuff. I need to like a spot to paste something temporarily. And that app is basically an evolution of the Edit app that came with NextStep from the beginning, from back in the late 80s. So that's sort of a, similar... vintage to Word, I guess. It's from the 80s. It's kind of a different thing. It's nowhere near the monster of features that Word is, but it's a text editor. It's a thing. And I'm still using it every day.
I think there should be some sort of Metallica cover called Monster of Features.
Oh, I like where you're going with that one. Okay. So, Earl... anything new of old that you're still using today?
Well, Jack reminded me, I had a different thought when I first read this topic, but Jack reminded me that I've been using Notepad since the beginning with Microsoft Windows, same scenario. Since it came out in 1985, Notepad has been in there, And I still use that on a regular basis, at least several times a week, just because it's there. I prefer Notepad++, but I will still pop open a simple notepad for just some quick notes that I want to take, or if I want to deal with something without any text formatting. The thing that originally came to mind, though, when I read the host topic was shortcuts in Windows, keyboard shortcuts. They've been remarkably consistent since the very first versions of Windows, and back then I memorized a lot of them in the 80s and continue to use them to this day to move around if I want to do something quick and don't want to have to reach over for the mouse to do it. I'm amazed, actually, how many of them still work, even in Windows 10 Professional. So that's my answer.
Yeah, I was just sort of thinking, didn't Windows originally have a slightly different cut-and-paste, shift-delete or control-insert or something, and then they just standardized on the control-C, control-V, control-X? But yes, it's basically been standard across all of the various iterations of Windows.
I mean, even tabbing around, maximizing a window, minimizing a window, you can do all of those things from the keyboard, just nobody ever does anymore. But
I raise my hand and say, sir. Yeah. Yes, I'd be one of those that does it. Even, was it Alt Space M for move, so that you can drag a window back into another screen? So yeah, there's plenty of shortcuts there that are still going strong.
Exactly, another keyboard checker, eh? Excellent.
Well, when you're using your AIX Unix Linux terminal session, your hand is on the keyboard, so sometimes you've just got to go with what's there. You know, it's so much effort to move the hand, you know, 12 inches across the table and then remember to hold the mouse correctly. I don't know, this GUI, it's so confusing.
It's for the birds, yeah. I think I recall that Jeff Raskin, of course, with Apple, early work on the Macintosh, believed that a lot of this moving off for the mouse and that was distracting and actually negatively contributed to computing, and did research in that. I can't remember the exact details, but I think to a certain extent he was right. You really do have to change gears mentally when you go from keyboard movement to mouse movement. It's still why I tend to prefer VI or its modern incarnations as a text editor, so I don't have to take my hands off the keyboard to do something else while I'm trying to work with a document. But I guess I digress. VI has been around a long time too, right? So
I was just about to say, that's another good example of the old software that's still being used. VI is not my natural environment.
And any moment now, I'll learn how to use it.
What you need is a handy hints guide to keep it with you, because I don't use it enough. But
apt-get installed Emacs.
Yeah, you use what you can and to get things going. But so let's see, what do I use new of old? Well, apart from the Office suite, which I think everyone does, so keeping on using in that. Still being inflicted with PowerPoint presentations and occasionally inflicting them upon others myself, so that's the forethought there. DOSBox, I'm actually using that quite regularly, both for myself and setting it up for others. So I use that to help. I've helped people set up old PC-DOS CDs, mainly genealogy CDs and other similar CDs in their new Windows and Mac systems, so that they don't need to go looking for updated user interface versions, which are, you know, horrendously more expensive, but contain basically the same data that is on that old CD. So DOSBox has some quite good uses that way. I've also used it to run small utility programs, because being the cheapskate that I am, I could never see the point of upgrading some of my software. So if I can run it in DOSBox or on the Mac Boxer, I'll do that just to keep using it. Like Earl, I'm a Notepad++ and a Notepad user. I suppose Notepad's not quite. It's only a new version, as in it's comes with the newer version of Windows, but I think it's intrinsically still the same program.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's amazing, actually, how much of the software that we use day-to-day actually has its roots right back into what we would strongly consider the retro computing environment. So there's more retro computer enthusiasts out there than that what people think they are, were, is.
And ever shall be.
Yes. So we have almost a whole planet of retro computer enthusiasts, and they just don't know it. Okay. So I think we'll park that one for a little while, and we'll see what other new releases of old software pop up. Okay. So, Paul, do we have anything interesting in user feedback?
Well, we have a couple of things. So one thing I wanted to point out is that Blake posted in on BytesSeller.com, basically in response to our question last week about how far do you upgrade, and he wrote about his adventures with his Amiga 2000 over a 15-year span of time, in which he acquired an Amiga 2000, decided that he wanted to upgrade it, then decided that he didn't actually use his upgraded thing and sold bits of it, and then decided he wanted to upgrade something different and bought more, and he sort of goes through the up and down grading of this machine for over through the years. But it's an interesting read, and it's it was nice to get the response. Carrington, some guy named Carrington.
Yeah, I know that name from somewhere.
Wrote in to point out that Usborne just released 5 more of their children's instructional computer books from the 1980s. So I think we talked about this when they first released the first set. These are those little sort of cartoony books about various computer literacy topics, and they just released 5 more. So we will have a link to that page that has both their sort of current kid-oriented computer books and their the new ones as well. So if you missed it the first time around, go check them out. I myself did not grow up with these, but I know that there are people who did and have nostalgia for them, and I think it's kind of interesting to see them. Are these familiar to any of you guys? From the past, that is?
Not particularly.
In the past, no. I was aware of them as titles that I'd see in the computer bookshops, but they were never anything that I was interested in getting. I suppose I was looking more for the technical references for myself to use rather than looking for introductory books.
With cartoons.
That's right. I think I remember flipping through them, but never actually having a need to buy them. Not having kids of my own, I was more interested in getting into the nitty gritty of these newfangled computer things myself.
Right. Yeah. So then the new ones seem to be Practice Your Basic, spelled in the Commonwealth way. Guide to Better Basic.
The correct way.
But yes, of course. Computer-controlled robots, experiments with your computer, and keyboards and computer music. So if you were missing those, you can now find them on the official site. They're not. It's not community scanning. This is Usborne itself making these available, which is also quite cool.
I definitely like it when the publishing houses come to the party on this and put their earlier books out there. It is part of the computing heritage, so it's good to see more of these titles being made available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's building goodwill for their future products too. But another thing that it's not new news, but it's sort of related. MIT Media Lab made Seymour Papert's Mindstorms book available. So that is a 1980 book that he wrote. This is the basically creator of Logo, and he wrote this book, which is quite influential, called Mindstorms, which is basically about teaching using computers in education. So this is 1980, so it does have, it refers to Logo and using Logo and, you know, refers to Piaget and kids' cognitive development and things like that, and math being, like using Logo as a way to kind of teach mathematical thinking without the obstacle of whatever psychological barriers there would be there. And it was a very influential book, I think, at its time. So it's kind of neat that it is now, again, basically officially available. And that, I think, is it for the feedback for now. Some people sent us links, which we will incorporate, and we'll try to mention where that happens later on.
Okay, well, thank you, Paul. Well, Earl, I think you can take us away in what's happening in interest and news.
Sure. Modern Vintage Gamer is a YouTube channel with a lot of interesting videos, and the two most recent are an amazing restoration of an Atari 1040 ST. Just love the work that he did here. It includes the removal of grime and stickers. The machine, when you first see it, is in pretty bad shape. It's missing some keys. It's dirty. It's got a half ripped off sticker on it. I don't think it has the floppy drive. I mean, it wasn't run over by a car, but aside from that, it definitely is worse for wear. So he takes it, he gets all that yuck off of it, he retrobrights it, basically gives it the hydrogen peroxide treatment, buys some replacements for the missing keys on eBay, adds actually a circuit. Apparently there were multiple versions of the motherboard for the 1040 ST, and the one that he had didn't have this circuit on it called composite sync. And the lack of that circuit made it difficult to get the 1040 ST to work with some modern flat panel monitors. So he actually solders that in, puts one of the GoTek 3.5-inch floppy emulators in it, as opposed to getting a vintage floppy. And by the end, the machine looks gorgeous, and it boots up, and he's playing some games on it, and all is wonderful and happy again. So we'll have links to, this is two parts, and we've got both of them up in the show notes, and I really enjoyed it.
Cool. Yeah, I think it would be sort of interesting to at least follow along. I don't have a machine like this, but this type of Atari and the Amiga always look very similar to me.
Yes.
They have some shared heritage, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Tramiel had gone over to Atari, and they lovingly dubbed the Atari ST machines the Jackintosh. And so, yeah, there is some both shared heritage and animosity between the two.
Right. Yeah, I think there was I think the Amiga team was working on something with Atari having an option to buy it or to acquire an exclusive license to what they were doing. And then Tramiel instead bought Atari and said, hey, we don't need what you guys are doing. We'll make our own 16-bit, 68,000-based machine. Whereupon then Commodore went and bought Amiga, roughly like that. So they were different teams. So they were very much from the same, you know, had the same kind of time origins roughly and whatnot. But yeah, it's very similar design and all. And I haven't watched these videos. I did sort of click through and skipped around. It is nice to see if nothing else, see the start and the end. It's a very nice transformation.
I've never seen the guts of a 1040 ST before. Definitely never seen under the electromagnetic shield part that's in the middle that has the video circuitry. So the teardown was kind of fun too. I was amazed how easily one of those things tears down. The late 80s computers really seem to have gotten into this where it was very easy to take them apart, that some simplified circuitry for both cost efficiency and also just made them easy to work on. So anyway, fun videos.
That has changed. You know, there was sort of an increase in modularity and swappability and repairability, and things are nothing like that now.
Mm.
You know, even for the machines that were, you know, sealed up, in this, for example, you could open them up and get into them. And that's one of the things I love when I get to see a machine for the first time in personal, is opening it up and seeing how it's constructed and the design ethic and everything. And you compare that to today's hardware, where it's the idea is to make it as thin and inaccessible as possible. And the worst thing I can think of is the way that componentry is effectively glued, sealed in place. We had manufacturers pouring resin over PCBs so that you couldn't see the chipset or the tracks and everything underneath, but not as a whole machine. But yeah, it's a whole different ethic these days. In how a machine is designed and manufactured.
Though, to be fair, I think, you know, if I were to open up my iPhone, I'm just too huge to work on the things that are inside it.
Yes, there's some new modern machines which I must admit that I've had to go and get replacement parts because my large, clumsy digits have inadvertently broken a connector or a sensor of some kind. But I still like to get in and work on my retro machines and also my current machines, but it's definitely getting harder in the modern day, so I'll just have to, I suppose, reallocate all of that time and effort back to my retro devices.
That's a really mind-bending perspective too, Paul. It's not that the parts are too small, it's that I'm too big.
That's right.
I like that.
Comes with age.
Yeah. Add in clumsy eyes with clumsy fingers and welcome to my world. Okay, Jack, 8-Bit Workshop.
Yeah, so this popped up a few months ago, and I have not been on the show since then. I've been meaning to mention it. A fellow named Stephen Hugg has created something called 8-Bit Workshop, which if you go to 8bitworkshop.com, it's an online 6502 assembler with an attached Atari 2600 emulator. So basically, you write assembly code, and it on the fly sort of reboots the emulator and runs it. And you can debug it and pause it and do all this stuff. And he's got there are a few different example programs you can start off with. This is kind of done as a companion to a book that he's published called Making Games for the Atari 2600. I have not read the book. I have a meaning actually to buy it because it looks kind of cool. It pretty much sort of, it's a neat way to sort of show all the different things that you actually can do with some simple examples. But just the fact that you can on the fly go and edit things. You can quickly, if you want to understand how you might change the colors and that sort of thing, you can sort of play around and mess with things. And you can build your own programs in there and save them and, I suppose, share them in some way. I haven't really delved into it enough, but it's really nice because unlike the traditional way of doing things where you would write some code in an editor and then fire up your assembler and then fire up your emulator, even if all those things are relatively quick, when it's all sort of on a single web page, it becomes a really tight loop when you're editing and saving changes and stuff. So mm-hmm. Pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that's quite wild. I am now tempted.
Yeah. And it looks like, I mean, there's certainly capacity for this where this would not have to be limited to an Atari 2600. He could extend this, I assume, for any kind of platform as long as he had a way to nicely integrate with a JavaScript emulator mm-hmm. on the website. And in fact, when you use the little pop-up menu on the site to choose an example, the URL field that fills in on the resulting as a result of that shows you in the parameters it says platform equals DCS. So he has room even in the URL scheme of the website it uses to allow for different platforms. I don't know when mm-hmm. when or if he'll get around to doing more, but so far so good. It's quite cool.
Mm. Yeah, having a look at the website, it's quite a nice design. I quite like the way that it's all laid out, and even just down to the 2600 below the screen, I think that's quite nicely implemented there.
Yep.
And a nice little subtle ad for to get the book Making Games for the Atari 2600.
Yep.
Which I think I might actually have a look at that.
Yep.
But no, that's a great little resource. And
so is the Making Games for the Atari 2600 book in fact first published December 2016?
Yes, it is the new book that he wrote now and made the website alongside of it.
Mm.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of like the good old days of including a floppy disk or a CD with your book. So
right.
All the working stuff is now up on a nice little website. Excellent. Yep.
So with this kind of stuff available to us, if we ever actually get a time machine, we can dominate the game market
by
writing things this way and then bringing them back to the 80s.
How did they do this? It'd be blowing people's minds.
Mm. Yes, get a VPN connection from the 80s back to today. A little bit of a temporal distortion. Okay, well, one I've got here is about the Decatron Witch. Now, I've covered the Harwell Decatron Witch over at the National Museum of Computing in the UK, and that is a very interesting restoration rebuild project in its own right. But over on Hackaday, I don't know how I missed this previously, but someone is creating a modern recreation of the Decatron. So they have basically a solid state replacement for the tubes themselves, and they have it built in into a very well designed wood and acrylic presentation display, so that it can be it's modular, so it can be moved around and taken, exhibit and shown off, and it's very well thought out implementation, solid state implementation of the Decatron. So even if you're not into tube technology, this is quite an artistic. Some of those screenshots definitely deserve to be turned into some desktop wallpaper, which I think I will do this evening. But
well, it's quite possible that if you turn the light out, it'll look just like a real thing.
Ah, yeah. So, So over at Hackaday, they've got this. So follow that project if you're interested in what Hackaday bring up. But also go over to his own homepage, and he's got a fundraiser for the actual real, the original machine. So it's good to sort of compare what is being done with the modern day solid state, compare that against the size and just the look of the original Witch. Mm-hmm. So it's good to see two different approaches to one, a full restoration of the original hardware, and another one using modern day circuitry to show the design and workings of that. So I know which one's a little bit easier to move around and demonstrate, but I do like the look of the original, but this modern day one by Dave is quite a great little implementation. So wouldn't mind seeing either.
Cool.
So has anyone got something similar to this hiding down in their basement?
Not quite.
Not that I'm aware of, unless it's hiding under something.
I was going to say, you just have no idea what you've got hide. I think even this one would have a few parts poking up amongst the others, so yeah.
I was just actually cleaning, trying to sort of like reclaim some space, and so basically taking out a bunch of my, I don't know what they are, you know, like 19-inch, 20-inch big CRTs, you know, anonymous brand, nothing interesting things that I'd kept around, and I managed to get, you know, carry 8 of them out, and that helped a fair amount, and then I moved around some more things, and I found 2 more that I didn't know I had, so it is possible for things to be hiding in these spaces that I didn't know about, but no witch, I don't think.
No witch hiding there? Oh, what a shame. Well, Paul, Stranger Things C64 game prototype, so if there was anyone who has a collection of Stranger Things, you'd be the man to talk to it.
So, yeah, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the television program Stranger Things, but it's what was it? I think it's a Netflix original thing, which is basically it's actually sort of Stephen King-esque. It's sort of like 80s horror movie kind of stuff set in the 80s, and it's actually really, really quite interesting to see. You know, they did a pretty good job of actually doing everything pretty period correct. It's not particularly a computer related thing, but you know, for fans of the 80s, there's plenty of 80s stuff to like about it. But so there's a group of people who are these people, the Digital Eclipse team, Mike, Mika, and John Gibson, I guess, who put together, they thought, you know, well, since this show is set in the 80s, there should be a video game that runs on 80s computers, you know, sort of based on the premise of the show. So they built up basically they mocked up something on a Commodore. I think they actually started with the music and then realized that it was going to be possible to do on the C64. And so they mocked up what the game might look like in very, you know, 8-bit Commodore looking graphics. Actually, it's kind of cool. You can even see on the wall of one of the screenshots, they have, even though you can't read it, it's very clearly identifiable as a poster for The Thing. Movie, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing. But anyway, so apparently they put this together, and there's some kind of neat screenshots and a relatively short sort of like video showing they call it a prototype. It's kind of a mock-up. I don't think there's anything actually playable. They pitched it to Netflix, and they never heard back. And that's the end of the story. So we don't know if Netflix even heard them, but at any rate, somebody made this thing, and basically I think the project, they've given up on actually completing the thing, but it's kind of neat to see. So
I just got done watching the first season of that on Netflix and enjoyed it quite a bit, especially the 80s feel. And mm-hmm. I thought the acting was particularly good too. I very much enjoyed that series, especially the kids' acting. You know, that can be pretty hit and miss, but I think the kids they got for this did a fantastic job. And I also think that a game on an 80s computer for that 80s series would have been perfect. Probably would have had a limited audience is the only thing. But, yeah. But you know, in terms of appropriate, that would have been cool.
It would have been.
Yep.
Mm. And perhaps they could have even woven it into the plot so that now they can, you know, the fourth episode of the second season, they're playing the game and they figure out what they need to do based on what happened in the game.
Right.
Now, that'd be interesting.
I remember a movie from the 80s that had what was it called, Cloak and Dagger. Like in the movie, there was a game that they played that actually ran on. It was either ran an Atari 8-bit or an Atari 5200. It was not a game that was actually released, but it was a game. I think the bootleg did leak out eventually in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also there was also a game that came out afterwards that was a sort of, you know, had the same name as the movie. It was not necessarily the same game that was in the movie, but the plot involved playing this game on the computer in some way. Anyway, yep. It would have been cool to have something similar for this too, but maybe season two.
Right. Which I think is coming. So.
Yeah, I think so too.
Oh, maybe we should get Earl to to be a consultant to the show.
Well, I'm sure the creators are listening to us now. So,
oh, of course,
most creators are.
Yeah.
So, Earl, seeing we're lining up a second job for you, I see that you've got something which is quite near and dear to me.
Well, indeed, this might almost qualify as a second job, if you count the month of April, the Retro Challenge. April 2017 event is open for entrants. So if you want to join in on the fun that is Retro Challenge, it begins on April Fool's Day, perhaps appropriately, and runs through the month of April. And the rules are simple as always. You just do something interesting with old computers and you blog about it. You let the world know what you're doing and how you're doing it. A couple of the sample entries that they've got in there so far, people have signed up to, here's one to create a multiplayer text adventure game, which I think sounds really interesting. It would be hosted on a modern system, but would be connected to from retro computers. The second is building one of the ZX80 clones that TimeMouth Software has put out called the Minstrel ZX80. These look really nice, by the way. And I'm an official member of the TimeMouth Software fan club, having watched their products and actually using one of their products in my Commodore PET. So there's more on the way. If you're interested in this, we'll have a link up in the show notes. And I think I'm going to join in on this one. I skipped the last one because just didn't think time was going to work out. But
We've got 6 entries so far. So John and I will be doing the judging again.
Oh, yay. Excellent.
So if I were to enter with something like an adventure game wherein you and John were characters in the game that were royalty, would that help? We'll see.
Well, it wouldn't hurt. Oh, no, look, John and I both had entries in the last Retro Challenge, so...
Yeah.
But did you recuse yourself is the question.
I didn't judge mine, and John didn't judge his.
But, there you go.
We were, I can't speak for John, but in my case, it was a did not complete, which I suppose is par for the course for me. But there was just so much tremendous entries in there that, in all honesty, if I did finish mine, it would have been an also-ran. Just there are so many creative ideas out there. And we try to make sure that, that we have prizes and awards for... different categories. Now, we don't have any hard and fast categories, so there were hardware projects, software projects, combinations. There were people doing restorations. It's the whole thing. It is basically giving people the avenue to take a retro project that they've been wanting to do, and then giving them basically a whole month to get in there. So whether they just want to work on it on weekends or every other evening or whatever, it doesn't really matter. The important thing is to find something, put it into an entry, and then just blog about it as you go through. And just following, I think we had nearly 40 entries last year. And if you think about it, that's quite a lot of retro work, and it's great to sort of see people's progressive work on it. It's great to have suddenly something new and interesting just sort of suddenly lob into the retroverse and you find out about it. But I actually like seeing the design and the thinking behind the ideas and the way people approach different things. So I'm really looking forward to following the projects that are put up there and waiting to see what you're going to put up there, Earl.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's a community building event. It's a motivator. It's just a lot of fun because a lot of us work on retro projects, but sometimes it's in the deep, dark retro cave just all by ourselves. And, this gives us a venue to get out there, and a time frame makes it, a measurable time-limited sort of event, which gets people up and moving. Yeah, it's just great fun.
Yeah. The other thing is it's also providing feedback into those projects. So there were a few projects there that had comments coming in through their blogs. People were tweeting about what they're doing and getting feedback there. So, it's a great community competition. I just... thoroughly loved it when I was participating in it and just watching it. And now as the co-judge with John, I thoroughly enjoy seeing what people come up with. So really looking forward to the 1st of April and to see what comes in this year. So, Jack, there's a little bit of competition going on here for the competitions.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Another challenge overlapping here. It's the annual Basic 10 Liners Contest, the 2017 edition that is kicking off, or I guess has kicked off. I don't really know what the start date was, but the end date is April 15th. And basically the idea is that you can build any sort of program you want, many of them are games, in a any version of Basic on any 8-bit computer that you want to use. So the idea is that any 8-bit computer, any line-oriented basic dialect, you're all set. And this has been going on for a number of years. I actually just looked right before we started, and on YouTube, if you Google for this, you can find lots of videos of the Basic 10 Lighters contest. Many of them are ones that Kevin Savage recorded a year ago, where he went through all of the Atari games. He was also sporting a monstrous, magnificent beard, which is visible in these videos. That is a reason enough, perhaps, to see these videos. But also, I just looked through, and some of them were amazing. Like, there was one that seemed like a more or less, well, very nearly complete version of Space Invaders in 10 lines of basic code. And in fact, just looking through, he was just playing the Atari 8-bit games, and a lot of those games in 10 lines seemed as good as or better than many basic programs, or many commercial programs I remember playing 30 years ago. So, but again, this is for all 8-bit platforms, basically. And you should go and check it out. If you feel like you want to polish your basic skills, go do it.
Yeah, this is I like this basic 10-liners contest as much as I do the Retro Challenge. And it is, to me, exactly the opposite of the Retro Challenge. So what we have here is a very constrained environment. Yes, it can be basic on any of the machines. But to code something useful in 10 lines, it's not just the getting your tight code and everything there. It is a beautiful exercise in software design so that you can actually get a great concept down. A lot of people have programmed in BASIC in the past, and I think this is just such a great way of getting back in there. Just to try doing something. And as you said, some of those programs that were put in as entries just felt so much better, as you said, than the commercial software we're using.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Yeah.
So if anyone out there is just looking for something to just tap away on a keyboard, this is definitely a great little competition to get interested in.
And it could be both. You could do the Basic 10-liner contest that is also your retro challenge.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's interesting.
Or you could write 10 of the lines before April 15th and then the second half in the second half.
Well, actually, I was just thinking that sort of if you aim at the 10 lines and get something beautiful and get that submitted in, all well and good, and then spend the second half of the month polishing it up, there's always going to be features that you wanted to put in but couldn't. There's going to be more documentation or whatever. This was my 10-line entry, and then this is how I'm packaging it up. And that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul, what's happening down in Brazil?
Well, funny you should ask. I happen to have a story about something that's happening down in Brazil.
Excellent.
So this is, again, this is something that I think we got a while ago. I'm not sure exactly. I think Tony may have sent it in as a link at one point. But so there's a site called Vintage is the New Old, which I think we have mentioned before. And so on this site, February 6th, 2017, there was an article about someone who was basically building a little model of a CP500, which is a TRS-80 Model 3 clone that was originally sold in, I guess, in Brazil. So on Vintage is the New Old, they have what is essentially kind of like a little bit of an overview and then a translation of an article that was originally in Portuguese. So if you want to read the English version, you can go to Vintage is the New Old. But I would actually suggest going back to the original Portuguese article as well for the photos, because the photos there are larger and more numerous. So the basic story is that this is Everaldo Lima, who was on the CP500 development team. It was a clone, but there was still development to be done. And apparently, somehow in this process, he worked for them. He helped put the machine together, but couldn't ever actually afford to have one of his own. So the new project is basically him building one, but he decided, because you know, there's no space, he would build a smaller one. So he's building a little reduced scale model. And I think it may actually be based on a Raspberry Pi as its brain. But so it's basically this goes through the process of building the little case and measuring things. And at the end, he has a little video. He has little virtual tiny diskettes that go in there and a small keyboard. It looks like the keyboard works. It looks like it's pretty small to type on, but at any rate, there's a little video that shows the thing running, and it makes little whirring noises, things when the disks are accessed and stuff. It is pretty cool. So if you just the pictures of the construction of the thing are pretty cool, and the actual machine looks pretty nice too. I would have to say that it's possible that some would call this heresy, but I think it looks better than the TRS-80 version. So. Anyway, have any of you had a chance to look at this before now?
I'd had a quick look at it when it came up on Vintages, the new old, but I had never gone across to the original Portuguese language site, and doing that now, and as you said, the pictures are bigger, better, more of them, but I just love that floppy drive.
It's quite cool. I actually don't think it does anything, does it? I think it just, like, lights up and makes noise. But
yeah.
But, I mean, I guess that counts as doing something.
Sorry, but what more do you need?
Right, exactly. But, yeah, it's pretty cool. And there's I think we'll also have a link to an information site about the actual, you know, full-size computer as well. I'm not sure exactly to what degree it is Model 3 compatible, perhaps quite. But anyway, pretty neat. Not a computer I'd heard about before this article, and it's pretty cool that somebody who is actually part of designing the original thing is now, you know, the one who's doing the little model. So that's it.
Okay, well, and what a coincidence! I think that's it for the news and what's new out there in the retroverse. Let's see, I see that there's been a few additions to the upcoming show roundup, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a couple that we didn't mention, and I think you will be the expert on those two, so if you want to just mention them. I think we alluded to them and didn't have the details properly down.
Didn't have the details at the time, but the first one in Australia coming up is here in Sydney, and that's going to be the WozFest PR6, so that's on April 29, so we'll have contact details for that. That's just really just a small Apple II enthusiasts get-together. This is the sixth one that Sean will be putting on. The previous one was WozFest 5.25, celebrating, funnily enough, the floppy disk, the media and everything. So it's a great sort of afternoon and evening event. We just brought our machines along. That was the last one. I took along my Microsoft Havoc and showed that to the guys. And we had video hookups to various luminaries. And pretty much Sean is going to be... doing a similar thing again on that one there. The larger show for here in Australia is going to be OzKFest, which is August 30th to September 3. And that one is going to be held up, not quite in Brisbane, it's nearby Brisbane. We'll have details on there at the Australian Apple II Enthusiasts website. And, yeah, there'll be a couple of nights on-site, Bribie Island, so either drive or catch the train nearby, and then we can get you across to the venue and accommodation. So there's currently a call out for that one for presentations. So as with most of these shows, the presentations are enthusiast-driven, and... So anyone who wants to attend and present will have contact and update details on our website for that as well.
Cool. Yeah, I was thinking that probably neither driving nor the train is going to work for me. It's going to have to be some other stuff.
there's going to be a little bit of a flight involved, I suppose, for... well, actually, there's probably going to be a flight involved for a lot of Australian attendees as well, because we are a largish place. More than a day trip for most Australians to get from one side to the other. Yeah, it should be quite a fun time for the OzKFest 2017. So if you're planning to visit Australia, maybe this would be a good time to drop in. It's like park the family somewhere else, let them run off and look at these touristy things, and you can pop over to the festivities, do a presentation, bring a computer with you. The more the merrier. So let's see. We got anything else new in the roundup?
No, nothing that I added anyway.
Okay. So here's a word from someone who might have been our sponsor.
Hello, I'm Hillary Stevens for Symbolics. Today we'd like to take this opportunity to show you Concordia, an object-oriented document management system from Symbolics.
Good morning, I'm Tom Diaz, Director of Software Products. First of all, then, I wanted to talk about the missions that set us on the particular course that resulted in Genera 7.0. Essentially, we felt in March of 1985 that it was time for software development at Symbolics.
Hello, and welcome to our presentation of the Symbolics S products. I'm your host, Matt Elson, and today we're going to look at what comprises the graphics software in the Symbolics environment. There are basically four key products.
Hi, I'm Steve Rowley. I'm one of the developers at Symbolics of a software product called Joshua. For the next few minutes, I'd like to show you a few examples of what Joshua can do for you as an engineer trying to develop a product that uses AI.
And we're back. So, gift idea time. Well, dear listener, this was actually much more difficult than it seems.
we were scrambling around during that ad.
Oh, it's always handy to have an ad break. But, what I had proposed isn't available, but what I have here now definitely is, and it is a wonderful source of amazement. So, over at our friends of Think Geek, there is the Tiny Arcade, a miniature arcade cabinet. Now, they say it fits in the palm of your hand, and they have photos to actually show. Not quite fitting in the palm of your hands, but it is teeny, it is tiny, and it is beautiful. And I got big clunky fingers, and I don't know how I'm going to play this. So.
Yeah.
Let's see, there's a joystick and there's fire buttons, and Michael's fingers will take up far too much room. But
there's space on either side.
There is space on either side, just come in, yeah. So it's basically, it's doable, and it is gorgeous. Okay, so what games can you play on this? It would seem there are many. So we've got Flappy Birds, Asteroids, Tiny Invaders.
Tinytris.
Tinytris, yeah. Yeah, I think it's a tiny platform for tiny games.
It's
a lovely little kit.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. What I saw, actually, the first picture you see is actually a clear acrylic. Yes. It basically looks like a stand-up arcade machine, except that it's, basically as tall as, your finger. but it looks like the kit actually comes with side art that you can stick on there that actually makes it look like a real box. It says Tiny Arcade on it, and has little, 1978 style art.
I think I'd have to buy two, so I could have one without the side art on it.
Mm-hmm. And it has a micro SD card slot or something like that, some storage, so that you can update it to play whatever you want.
Yep, there is an IDE for this. It runs some sort of Arduino processor, and you can extend this how you want, which is kind of cool.
Mm.
This seems like a perfect thing for playing on the airplane.
Not towards the end of the flight. That is such a cute little screen.
Oh. Yeah, you'd have to pretty much hold it right to your face, but
this is even better than I thought. Definitely putting this one into my wish list.
Yep.
Okay. Well, if you're after a tiny arcade that is exceedingly tiny. This could possibly be the gift that you need to let others know about.
I think I'm going to combine this gift with also a microscope. And
or like one of the Brazil style, you know, like Fresnel lens.
You could go and make a Fresnel lens adapter to sit in front of it.
Right. Like the old TVs. That'd be great.
Yeah, but would you have to put the game upside down? Like, wasn't that one of the problems with the... That'd make it interesting to play. Okay, enough fun and frivolity. Let's get down to some serious money here. So, Earl, what have you got there to relieve me of this ill-gotten gains of mine?
Well, I've always been fascinated by physical mechanisms for storage. Things like punch cards or mark sense cards or paper tape. And whenever I see something that looks like it has some potential on eBay, I'm interested in it. This is both a tape reader and a tape punch from DSI Data Specialties. I've never heard of them before, but it looks like an interesting mechanism that does both. And I think the starting bid is not that horribly ridiculous. It's starting out at $200. The shipping to me would be $58 from New York, so that'd be a bit costly. But on the other hand, I'm betting this thing is pretty heavy.
Well, I'm just looking in there, and I was about to say, that's pretty really good. So what, the note in here, was last serviced in 1991 and was retired a few years after that. It is heavy and weighs about 50 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Appears to be in good physical condition. So,
and also, the seller offers to make a custom data cable, if you want them to, so that you can hook it straight up to, I'm not sure what, your Arduino or something.
Oh, this has got Retro Challenge Project written all over it. So you connect that to a serial to USB adapter, and then you hook it up to a modern machine to both read and write out to paper tape.
Absolutely. So I just...
Well, what you need is two of these. So you have one punching the tape, the other one is picking up the spool on the other end and reading off the tape right after.
Like, oh, it's like a tape delay. Just being silly.
It's a digital delay.
As long as the reader is slower than the puncher, I guess that would work. Otherwise, the two machines would just kind of suck into each other in a vortex. But
singularity has been created.
Anyway, I like this. It looked like it was in good shape.
Oh, I do. Oh, please, someone out there, purchase this and make this your Retro Challenge project to connect it to a modern machine.
That'd be neat.
Actually, it's only $168.58 to ship it to Australia.
That's a deal at any price.
not quite any price.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Dream on, Michael. So, Jack, bring a dose of reality back into this if you can.
All right. I've got a couple of things here. One is an Amstrad PPC 512, which is maybe not that unusual a thing, except I've actually never seen this thing before. Once I saw it, I was like, wow, that thing looks really cool. And I Googled and I found 1,000 pictures of this thing. So apparently it's more popular than I realized. I just never seen it. Are you guys familiar with what this computer is?
Yeah, I've seen one in person one time, ironically, at the Retro Gaming Expo here in Portland.
Yeah, it's got a lovely little form factor. It's just
This luggable thing with a handle on the side.
I think it takes like 900D batteries or something, right? I think it actually does have like a big battery compartment that takes like cylindrical batteries.
Say, between that and your boombox, the Ever Ready Corporation will love you.
Yep, lots of batteries to power this thing. But I just love the way that like it's basically it's a box that unfolds into a computer. Like it has a pop-up screen, and you lay the screen down flat, and you can fold the whole keyboard up on top of that. It's pretty crazy. And this one is from a seller in Italy, and the item condition is listed as non testato, which yes. I believe means not tested.
I think that's Latin for caveat emptor, right?
Yeah. Or not male.
So for 80 euro, this could be yours. Or you could look elsewhere. There are probably more of these. But it's just kind of a cool thing that I just had not stumbled across before and wanted to point it out. It's pointed out its existence to our listeners because it's a pretty cool looking thing. Like I like the idea of this thing that folds up and becomes this nice little unit. From the days before, you can
I just love all the old portable and luggable computers before the notebook form factor came in and took over the portable computing world. This is a nice one. It actually looks great when it's all folded up and closed, and then it's,
it's pretty cool.
I've definitely been interested in trying to get a hold of one of these at some point, but I haven't seen any. The only sort of time I got close was one that was actually somewhat nearby, but the screen was broken somewhat. And I think these are, so it's a Super Twist LCD, and I think this is not an easy thing to replace. I think you need to find a different one to steal the screen from, and if you want to fix one of these. So, I did look it up, and it is it's 10C batteries. That's what this thing takes.
Excellent. The battery industry loves this.
Yeah.
So the other thing that I found that I wanted to share with our listeners is something that is of a category of item which I love, which is broken-looking Soviet computers. This is the Corvette SB8010. Untested, it says. And if you look at it, I think this has definitely been, in some sense, tested. It has run some sort of gauntlet.
No, I think they actually shipped this way.
Yes, the way it came. I think it looks like it's been thrown into a trunk of a car, and then the car was driven off a bridge and set on fire, and then somebody pulled this back out and ran it through a washing machine. Or I don't know. Like, it's got a lot of missing keys, and it just looks terrible, and it surely cannot be functioning. And it's yours for 27.5 British pounds. But I kind of like the way it looks. I imagine it doesn't do anything interesting, but I dig the sort of broken aesthetic. But I don't know anything. It says it's an i8080 clone for the CPU.
I definitely don't have one.
That's true. I suspect I probably never will. But
This is, as you said, it's beautiful in its own strange way.
Yep.
I'd like to have one that's got all its bits. No, I don't quite mind the discoloration and all, but it'd be nice to have all the operational keyboard and for it to actually work, just to sort of see what it is and what it can do.
Right.
But, it's interesting. They do have, it looks like the keys that are actually on there are in both Cyrillic and Roman letters too. I mean, like the stop key says stop in both forms, and it makes me wonder. I mean, I guess this must still be arranged in the Cyrillic way, though. So it's not ASDF. The D key, the P and the D and so forth correspond to their corresponding letters in Cyrillic wherever they can, but they're organized in what I guess must be the Cyrillic keyboard standard. Or maybe actually, just to be fair, they're arranged in neither standard, in just some random order.
Random keyboard.
Seems they got the numbers right.
Yeah.
Yep, that's true.
So before we switch over to Paul, I found a few interesting little items. The first one came up because I've got a standing search for anything that is microsize, so that basically looking for documentation and original discs or any companion media to the Microsi Havoc, which I now own. But Microsi also manufactured cards and peripherals for other systems, and mainly or predominantly the Apple II. So what we have here is a Microsi floppy disk drive. It said that it's an A2 clone, disk 2, 5.25-inch floppy drive. So when I see this box in the picture here, we're talking about a device that was designed and built in the 80s, but that box to me just sort of looks so 50s.
Yeah.
just the design, the way it's presented. It just you know, if you just saw that, you'd automatically think 50s. But no, it's much more modern than that. It's also frightfully expensive. I think I'd rather have the paper tape punch reader than this little floppy drive. But I just thought I'd show something that it's for a mainstream computer, but it's by another manufacturer and the things on there. So, you know, for people out there who like to collect the peripherals to the machines, this might interest you.
The most of the time when I see Microsoft stuff, it is this drive. It's the A2 drive. But they also made a couple of other things. I don't see it actually. Like, on the box, there are some checkboxes, you know, that say, like, A40, A2, A3, A1, U143. There was one, I think there was a A74 or something like that, which doesn't seem to have its own checkbox there. But they made a couple of actually fairly desirable drives. The A143 is... Like, I also have a standing search because I'm trying to get one of those. It's basically a double-density, double-sided Apple II-compatible drive and Apple III-compatible, too. So that's actually where I mostly hear about them is those are the drives you want for the Apple III. So, anyway, that's all. Well-respected company, I guess.
Okay, now the... other offering that I've got here is a CBM Professional Computer Guide from 1982. So this is back to my first love of books. So maybe, Earl, you might be interested in this book. Or do you have a copy?
I don't have a copy of this one. It does look kind of interesting. Commodore had made an effort to take the technology of the PET and kind of... pivot toward the business world with their CBM line, and it would be fascinating to see inside this book if it is targeted for the business professional as opposed to targeted at the hobbyist.
I notice also that it is the first author is Adam Osborne. Is that not, isn't that the Osborne of Osborne?
Of Osborne. I believe it is.
Yeah. Cool.
I always find it interesting when stray books pop up in my searches, if anyone's after any the earlier computer books, this one might find a spot in your collection.
Yeah, the random books that always pop up for me are things like, you know, Apple Recipes Volume 2. Annoyingly enough, they contain all my search terms, but...
Okay, so speaking of your searches, Paul... what have you found to delight us this time?
Once again, I have a fairly random list of things. So the first thing is something called Redguard Data Protection. The Redguard Data Protection is basically, it is a couple little devices that you can plug in to your phone line that protects modem data from phone line interruptions. And so they have a little picture, they're a little red, you know, like they look a little bit like the splitters or the DSL filters or whatever that you used to put on your phone line, your landlines back when there were landlines. And the picture on the front is actually quite nice. It's a, you know, it's someone, you know, a parent talking on the phone and a kid, like, maybe, I don't know if it's a kid. I see it as a kid, but maybe it's the other household member. With you know, the head down on the keyboard, and it says communication line failure. It's very nice. But so here's something that no one is ever going to need again. Still pretty funny to see. And it's only $8.99, buy it now. So.
And you can do the whole house because it comes with three of them.
Yep. So. The photos actually show you the back too, so you can see a little bit more about the. I don't know how they work exactly.
I was going to say, how does that work? You know, if you've ever had anyone pick up an extension in the house when you were on the modem, it's like, get off the phone! I'm trying to compute.
Suddenly the garbage comes across the screen.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, see, also, with Redguard in place, you no longer have to worry about someone listening to your private phone or conversations. So I think it must actually be somehow sensing... like a drop in voltage or something that would occur if there's another extension picked up something. But anyway, interesting and strange. Okay, the next thing I'm not actually sure in what form these came, but there's a seller who has some TRS-80 video display worksheets, and so these are basically their sheets of paper. They're coming in sets of five. My guess is they actually came in a big pad, and this seller
probably
is splitting them up into fives.
Yeah.
But and apparently this seller only has 15 total, since there are three sets of five available. But it's basically a grid, like graph paper, set up specifically for the screen on the TRS-80 video display. And then on the back, actually, there's also a basic coding form that is, I guess, arranged in characters on the screen so that you can by hand write your basic programs. So they have a little column in the left for the line number. On the right, they have a variable list and comments, and then they have a bunch of grid spaces for apparently one character at a time. So this is, I guess, for programming when the power's out.
Another fine, useful product from Radio Shack.
Sounds like when would I use that? But by the same token, for instance, at I could see students using this, because at my high school, the TRS-80 that we had was a shared resource. So if you wanted to write your basic program and do that when you didn't have direct access to the computer, then maybe something like that would have come in handy. Pretty limited use case, though, I think. But the screen layout actually looks like it could have been useful. As I recall, the TRS-80 had kind of two fat pixels in both dimensions per character, right? So if it was a 64-column screen, you had 128 monochrome pixels horizontally and 25 lines, so you'd have 50 fat pixels vertically. And seeing what that, getting a visual of what that would kind of look like on a worksheet like this, could have been handy.
Yeah, I've seen some, I searched around a little bit on the web. I didn't save any of the links, of course, but I've seen at least one place where someone posted photos of some of these from the olden days when they were designing a game, the actual, part of the design documents of something. So you can see them being
used
in that way.
As modern times as well, I've actually got several blocks of iPhone 4-sized post-it notes, which have the screen gridded out so that you can actually draw your user interface and sort of storyboard what you're doing. So, and they're great. They're also great to use as post-it notes when you're sort of like annotating a document or something, and people go, "Hey, what?"
Yeah.
But making these for 1080p resolution, that would be kind of hard.
Yeah. The retina grid.
The retina worksheet, right?
Yeah, it folds out so that you can write on it.
Yeah, so I did find one link to a game called Donut Dilemma, which is Nicolas Morente's best game for the TRS-80 Model 1, and has a bunch of screenshots and stuff like that. But in there are a couple of filled out versions of, that show designing the characters and the donuts and things like that this game. So you can see how they're supposed to be used. Pretty cool. Let's see. The next thing I had is a vintage JCPenney's computer data recorder, cassette player, recorder 8-bit. 1980s, it says. I'm just reading the title. But the actual name of it is the computer program data recorder. And it basically, this is just a generic, not machine-specific, but intended for computer use specific, if that is a hyphenated word, a little cassette recorder. So it's got a cassette player. It has level meters. It has a volume thing. All the controls are on the top. It has a speaker and a pause button. So it's kind of designed specifically for playing audio into your computer that was contemporaneous with it. So now retro. And I thought it looked, it looks kind of neat. So if you're looking for, I think it might actually look a little better than the kind of standard Panasonic Radio Shack or whatever, rectangle with a handle kind of tape players.
It does. This thing looks really nice. The industrial design of this is cool.
The description says that it was used with a Timex Sinclair 2068, which was their fourth and last home computer for the U.S. market.
I can't quite tell what color this is, but it looks like it could almost kind of fit in with the 2068's color scheme. Oh, I see. Oh, there's a picture. You can see the 2068 in one of the photos, just slightly off to the edge there. So it looks like the tape player is beige, and like more beige than the gray of the 2068. Yeah, I actually got a 2068 a few months ago from somebody local who was getting rid of one. It seems I'm kind of looking forward to playing with it. It's kind of like the U.S. version or maybe North American version of the Spectrum, except it's not quite Spectrum compatible. So it's kind of a useless machine in a way. But it's possible to get a cartridge that has the Spectrum ROM on it that you can use to kind of turn it into a Spectrum. But I have the cartridge that I need to sort of solder together, and then I need to somehow source the ROM. So I'm not very far along on this project.
It looks like somebody took a Dymo label maker and noted what you should use for the settings on saving and loading. And that's an interesting idea, because I always did find that to be a little tricky. Like if you were using the Atari and the Commodore tape units were directly connected in to the specialty connectors of the machines. But if you had a more generic scenario like the Apple or the Timex Sinclair or something like that, you never quite knew what volume should I set this sucker at to get an optimum load.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, so that's one other thing that's kind of nice about this is that it's a one dimensional slider. It's not a little rotating knob that you can't quite read, and can't see when you're normally looking at the tape recorder. It's very clear where it's set. So nice. Okay, let's see. So the next thing, is it still here? It is. I thought this was kind of interesting. There's a couple of things here, actually both from the same seller, that are relevant to early IBM PCs. So the IBM PC 5150 type era. So the first is an 8087 math coprocessor in the box. And I thought that was kind of cool just because it's in the box. I've never seen the box. I guess it's not surprising that they came in boxes. this is, I think even the 5150 has a slot on the, not slot, you know, socket on the motherboard to put one of these in. It's basically just a math coprocessor that you can offload some of your math operations to. And the box is a little bit beat up, but it is there. And it looks like the box is used for any of a number of the models, including a 387, 8087 family, 287 family, 387SX family. But the box itself is the 8087 version, and so is the chip. I'm a little disturbed by the fact that in the photos you can see, it's kind of a nice box. And to show that we have this, he has put the chip right there on the carpet.
I saw that too. I think it's actually a towel, if that makes you feel
better. A towel on the carpet.
Oh, yes.
That's to enhance the static.
Yeah, I see.
Super static.
Well, I guess if you look at the, that is sort of matching the photo on the front of the box, but where the sort of beams of something emanating from the chip. But anyway, yeah, so who knows if it actually works. But I thought the box was kind of cool. And if you have a 5150, perhaps, this is a kind of a standard option, so I bet there's a lot of software that would be aware of it if it was there.
And even if you had one with a Maths coprocessor installed, I doubt that you'd actually have the box in the literature that it came in if it was done as a aftermarket install. I'm liking this just for the packaging.
I think that's the main attraction to this. I think there are other sources. If you just want to get the 8087 that wasn't on a towel. But it's not too expensive, actually. It's a buy it now of basically $30, so it may not last super long. I think this was just listed yesterday. The other 5150 related thing I have is IBM game control adapter. So I think this works on PCs or XTs as well. But this is basically a card that lets you plug in a joystick for those early IBMs. And not something I'd seen before. I've seen the joysticks, but I hadn't seen the card that they go into. So, and again, you know, it's what I think is probably most interesting about it is, you know, just getting the packaging. So.
This is pretty cool. I could actually use one of these. I don't have a joystick port in my PS2 Model 30, which is, for most intents and purposes, like a souped-up XT with ISA slots. So, cool.
Yeah, it's pretty wild when someone has saved these things for so long. I mean, it's very annoying when I think back to all of the boxes and things I threw away without any record of what they looked like. But, oh well. I'm going to call that the end of my eBay.
Well, that is a very interesting array of items. So get your wallets ready, folks, and see what you can buy. Okay, so let's close this out. So if there's anything that you want to talk about. So, Earl, I see you're doing a little bit of data compaction.
I am. Actually, space compaction in this case. When I worked at an aerospace company in the 80s, we had a giant IBM mainframe, and it ran the MVS operating system, and we had TSO, the time-sharing, I'm not sure what component, I guess is the best way to say, running on that, and lots of terminals connected up to it, et cetera, et cetera. Took up a whole room, had a Halon fire suppression system, had operators in there running around. And so I wondered, being that it's 2017, could I cram all that into an Altoids can? And it turns out I probably can't cram in the fault tolerance and some of the I/O performance and a bunch of terminals, but I can't cram...
Nor the Halon.
No, not the Halon either, exactly. But I can cram some of the functionality of that into that amount of space. There is a mainframe, an IBM mainframe emulator package called Hercules. It's been around for a long time. Along with that is what's called a turnkey version of MVS 3.8J, which I believe is the last version of IBM's MVS operating system that was publicly available. And I believe it was early 80s anyway. I can't remember exactly what year that version of MVS came out. But you can get this freely and install it and run it on a Windows machine or a Linux machine. In my case, I decided to do this on a Raspberry Pi 0W, which is the latest of the Pis. This is a Pi 0 that has Wi-Fi and Bluetooth Low Energy tacked onto it. It's a $10 computer. It easily, several of these will fit in the palm of your hand. And having it run the equivalent operating system of that mainframe, I just thought, this is great. This is COBOL in a can. So so there you go. It's actually hanging from the power cord up on one of my shelves here and running that Hercules emulator. I'm tying into it with a 3270 emulator software. So one of those things that you do just because you can, I guess.
And congratulations.
So it really does run. Because I also wanted to try this, something like this.
Yeah, it runs quite well, actually.
So, yeah, I forget if you were here when we were talking about this before, but I would like to do that. But I have a... I've forgotten what the number is. I'm trying to look across the room and can't quite see it. It's a 3270 terminal cluster controller that I want to connect to.
I remember you talking about that.
Someday I'm going to try that, but at least the idea, the fact that Hercules runs on the Raspberry Pi Zero, in fact, actually, I could put the Raspberry Pi Zero W inside the cluster controller.
Yes.
That's what I will do.
Can connect to yourself.
That's pretty excellent. Because, of course, the cluster controller itself is kind of like, you know, it's maybe as big as a half height 5150. So...
Okay, so, Jack, can you trump that?
I don't know if I can trump that, but I can say that I have had all of my kind of retro computing stuff and other electronics and cables and cords and doodads and whatnot. I've been sort of spread all over the house in weird configurations and weird spots, which made it difficult for me to do things sometimes. Like, oh, I needed to have this piece of something. Where am I going to put this together? So I finally carved out a space in my workroom where I can have all of my stuff boxed and fairly well organized, and I have a workspace, a tabletop. I can pull my stuff out and do my things. And the other boon along with this was that one of my kids got a new big computer screen for her gaming computer for Christmas. And so she had an older monitor left over, like a 19-inch screen, standing around. I was like, well, what am I going to do with this? And I realized, hey, this thing has RF input, composite input, component input, HDMI, VGA. Like, it has, it's a very versatile thing. I realized I can use this for everything from my ancient 8-bit stuff all the way up to being a secondary screen for my main work laptop. So I suddenly have a nice, cool space for all of my crap, which is great. And this inspired me to then also pull out my old Atari 2600, the actual device, which I seldom use, and try and hook it up to the screen. And like I did, it's a digital monitor, so it has like the typical thing where it'll scan the RF signals and you can fine tune it. And I tried to sort of zoom in on where the device was, and I could get some picture sometime, but it just looked totally lousy. And so I finally realized, okay, now's the time for me to upgrade this old thing. I went and ordered online a kit that you solder in here to give you a composite out on this device instead of just the RF cable, which it has. So I'm excited to breathe some new life into that old thing.
Beautiful.
But I haven't done it yet, and my soldering skills aren't the best. So, but I'll let you know how it goes.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, not much has been happening here. I've been trying to clear some space to get one of my VZ300s out so I can actually get round to seeing if it does work. You know, it was one of those eBay things where it was sold as untested, but it was too good a collection of bits and pieces. So see if I can get that operational. Nothing else much. But Paul, what have you been up to?
Well, yeah, so I guess one of the things that I have been doing recently is carrying old monitors out, trying to reduce the footprint of everything. And I think there is going to be something that's, I think will help motivationally to have everything kind of like clean again, findable again.
Lift with your knees.
Yeah. Yes. I've also gotten a whole bunch of translucent bins that everything is going in, because it turns out that random cardboard boxes do not easily reveal what is inside, and I have many, many random cardboard boxes. So soon I will be able to at least eliminate visually corners of the room that things can't be in. So there's that. The other thing. So just today, let me walk through the story a little bit, but. Who sent this? Steve sent this over the RCR podcast feedback. He pointed out Symbolics Frame Grabber IO board and gave an eBay link. And so that is, it's a Relic Scientific Computer 1983 Symbolics 3600 170082 Frame Grabber IO board. It is a starting bid of $25,000. So that's a lot. I think this probably will remain unsold. Oh, actually, also the seller has no feedback. Even better. but I thought, well, all right. That reminded me a little bit to go look into what Symbolics is. And so I don't think this came up on the show, but recently there have been a couple of Symbolics things that have gone by. So there were a couple of Mac computers, a Quadra 700 and a Quadra 650, that had in them Mac Ivory Symbolics cards, and they went for thousands. And so I kind of wanted to check to see, like, what is this? I sort of knew Symbolics went with Lisp machine, and so I kind of did a bit of research, and indeed, so Symbolics made a couple of things that were in fact basically machines that were optimized to run Lisp code. So, and they originally made you know, big machines that were Lisp machines. And then later on they did, they had these cards that would go inside Macs, you know, and then had the Lisp interpreting chip on it. But so those are the things called Mac Ivory, and I think there were three of them, Mac Ivory 1, 2, and 3. And they, you know, they would go in Macs that had Nubus slots. So so basically, I guess, in a sense, the Quadra was serving as the enclosure, I guess. But so I thought, all right, well, first of all, it's kind of an interesting thing. You know, it's a little bit like those fourth computers, right? This is a computer that's built specifically to run Lisp. And so I wanted to I looked around to see if it was possible to emulate this, and it turns out that you can emulate this. So the system that is running it is called, or the one of the things that you would run on a Lisp machine is called OpenGenera, and or Genera, I don't know. I read it like it's generic without the it's like the car name version of generic, Genera. But at any rate, it was possible, it turns out, to install OpenGenera in Linux running in VirtualBox. So there's a page that Seth Morbido put together that I was able to walk through all the way through, you know, from step one to step whatever, and installed Ubuntu, got the various bits in off the internet and started it up, and was able, you know, got to the Genera, OpenGenera screen, at which point you're running this thing called a Lisp listener, and so you can type commands at it, and I have no idea how to get any further, but it's also actually one thing I found kind of tricky is that if you had an actual machine, you know, like a Symbolics machine, you would have a keyboard with a gazillion different little modifier keys, which are kind of hard to replicate on an actual keyboard. I needed to figure out how to type delete, because backspace doesn't work. Delete, you know, just backspaces. And I had to figure out how to type end, which I didn't have on my laptop either, but apparently it was option right arrow, function right arrow. But anyway, but it was kind of an interesting beginning. So that's what I was doing, is I was installing and then starting and then stopping. OpenGenera and VirtualBox. That was my closing discussion, I guess. Has anyone else ever played with this?
No, I haven't. I'd be interested to hear, as you go forward, what you learn about this. I had to use Lisp one time in my artificial intelligence course, and I found that it made me very comfortable with parentheses. I think that the key mapping that you're talking about seems to have shades of, like, you remember the old APL language where they had specialized keyboards for that? And if you didn't have one of those, it was kind of tough to program in that language. This sounds a little bit similar. I wonder what all the modifier keys do.
Mm. I remember trying to get more familiar with Lisp on the old Apple II Euro Pluses. I've still got the folder documentation and original disks for the Lisp interpreter for the Apple II. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we used to say that Lisp stood for the liberal insertion of superfluous parentheses.
I'm sure. Yeah. Lisp is somewhat separable from OpenGenera in that I sort of skimmed through some of the documents, but I think it works a little bit like these fourth machines in that, you know, there's kind of like a set of definitions that make up the operating system, and then when you basically just add more objects to the world that interact with each other. So in fact, actually, one of the first steps you need to do is save the world so that you can restore the world later if you need to. But I think all the modifier keys and stuff like that have to do with more of the interacting with the operating system. Not so much the actual Lisp commands, but isn't APL stands for a programming language, does it not?
I believe so.
I think you're right.
Okay.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah. Fairly modest name.
Yeah.
Several years ago, I applied for a job a decade ago, where they were using APL or a modern version of JPL. They did not require special keyboards. I think it's called JPL or something, but it's all the same concepts, just mapped to the keys we actually have available in the modern world. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get the job. I remember because they knew that everyone applying for this job, like, no one knows APL. So everyone But they found me interesting enough to at least let me sit down. They had sort of a lab set up, and they had people come in. I think there were like four or five of us all in there all at once. And we got an instruction sheet saying, okay, here are some things you can do with this setup. Try and see if you can figure out how to do this and this and this. And it was pretty tricky, and I didn't get the job. But it was kind of fun to play with, though. Very, very different from any kind of programming I've seen before or since. Hmm.
Yeah, back in my early days, I remember when I was doing support, and I had to go up to one of the actuaries' offices, and he was having a problem with his 3270 terminal with an APL keyboard on it. And yes, it was a very interesting and colorful keyboard.
Yeah, these machines, I mean, like, you cannot find a real Symbolics machine. I mean, they are super, super expensive if they ever come up. And finding just pieces of them isn't all that useful either. I think this is, you know, it was just down the road from me. I mean, I think this is MIT offshoot company, but oh well. Maybe someone will find one in a closet and give it to me.
That's a very scary closet. Okay, well, I think that's a wrap for today's show. So you can find notes for the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us on the forums at vcfed.org. And you can, of course, follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. Or you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. And, of course, we love to receive feedback from that good old standard of email. So send something along to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're also a member of the Throwback Network, so pop over there and see what other retro-inspired podcasts might interest you. And, of course, to help others find out about us, please write us a review on iTunes. So, everybody, until next time...
Retro Compute.
Nice.